I'm Mike Shaver. I work for Zero Knowledge Systems. I'm going to be speaking today about open source practices, things I've experienced, things other people in this room I'm sure have experienced, some interesting questions that are left to be answered. I expect there will be a hefty portion at the end for question and answer, so if you hold your questions till then, we can have more fun with them, I think. So there's a couple of main categories I'm going to talk about today. The first is what I sort of traditionally think. I think of the open foo world as divided into two major parts. One's open source, mainly licensing, publication, you know, meeting the open source guidelines for your license so you can use the trademark, that sort of thing. The more interesting chunk, from my perspective, because it's more difficult, is open development and the tools and practices we use to make that happen, successes we've seen, issues that still need to be resolved. And an item that's especially close to my heart there is the issue of tree ownership. Notion of who maintains whatever level of control there is over a chunk of the source, the tree as a whole, who gets to make the big decisions, or if they're made at all. And then they're going to conclude with this is really hard to do sideways. Talk about some of the questions that are still out there remaining to, for me anyway. If people have answers to them, they should jump right in with them at that point. So one of the interesting things about that's happened came in mainly, I guess, over the last 2 years or so is this distinction in some people's minds between free and open source software. In a lot of circles, it's a pretty narrow difference. The most consistent usage, I guess, is by obviously the Free Software Foundation, who are consistent in their usages of most of these things, where free is typically a strong copyleft. They've broadened that somewhat to refer to a lot of licenses, mainly those that are open source guidelines compliant. But I think the more commonly used term, and it's interesting to see that this is the one that's really been picked up in the press and Wall Street and all these other traditional enemies of software, is open source software. So I think there's some damage being done to the community there, and people have written about this in the past. By having these two categories, having it not be clear how they relate, and not be clear which category people are interested in having their software be in. So pick a term. One thing that comes out of that a little bit is this license spectrum we've had developed. There are a lot of licenses out there now. And when I started actually at Zero Knowledge, when we decided we were going to do open source stuff, one of the few things I was pretty adamant about was that we were not going to write our own license. Because I've been through that process once before, and I believe that nobody should ever have to go through that process again. It seems credible to me that we're pretty much done making new licenses. You got a pretty wide spectrum of permissiveness. You got a pretty wide spectrum of what the FSF terms copyleft, which is sort of forward-looking characteristics of the license to ensure the continuing freeness or openness of the software. And you go from X11 and public domain on the far side and X11 through to the GPL, which is probably the strongest copyleft you can have. In terms of the desires of the license, whether the license itself is crafted in such a way to meet those in a court of law is still an open question, and one that is sort of tricky to answer, unless there are any judges in the room. I don't think there are, because they're all watching Rusty. So the one piece that's sort of left there as a new license to do is quite possibly a stronger version in a legal sense of the GPL. And I understand there have been some lawyers at a large software company that have been working on a license that meets the same aims as the GPL and has basically the same characteristics, but is written sort of in a more lawyer-friendly way. The GPL is pretty lawyer-friendly as it is in its terminology, but in terms of the areas it falls, in terms of what it requires from your software, in terms of what it permits and what it doesn't, there's being some work being done there. So that would be, in my mind, a really strong addition to the GPL version 3. Would just be a sense of greater sort of comprehensibility in the legal community. I know when I was working at the Mozilla source release, one of the issues that kept popping up was that our lawyers were not always confident they understood exactly what the GPL meant in a couple areas. And I think that sort of does a disservice to the community that's chosen that license for their software. It's not clear what a court of law will do with that license if it's ever faced with it. So far, it hasn't been. So far, the threat of court action has been enough to get most people back in line, or what people think the line is. But there's sort of a time bomb ticking there, and it'd be good if the next version of the GPL could really address some of that, make it clear for people what they're really doing with their software when they put it under this license, and make it clear for people who are using the software what they're really constrained by, what their rights really are. In terms of publication, we have a pretty good story right now in sort of the open community. SourceForge for work in progress and Fresh Meat for work that's well, often still in progress, but also in sort of a, it's the next step up to the granularity of release, things that the authors are pretty sure run and have some valuable characteristics for you, even if it is a visual version of true. So that's not too bad an area. The publication one brushes against something that's important in the next piece here, which is the open development section. Please.
Yeah.
Which is how you deal with sort of general feedback and how you interact with your community. Publication's obviously one of them. A publication tends to be a pretty one-way thing from the developers of the software out. And that's traditionally how software has been distributed. I'm going to skip all over these slides. In the general feedback category, though, it's not clear that those mechanisms provide a good way to do it. It's not obvious when you take a piece of software from Freshmeat what you do if you have commentary about it, depending on what that commentary is, if you find a security bug, what you do if you have a feature request, what you do if you have simply a question about how the software works, where you discuss that sort of stuff. Once upon a time, that might have been something you discussed in Usenet, but nobody discusses anything in Usenet anymore, so not as useful. And this is, again, the area where I think there's a lot more work to be done and a lot more interesting return. Open development as a notion of having developer community that spans sort of traditional organizational communities. You've got people working for different companies. You've got people in different geographic areas. You've got people who are on different ends of the commercialism, capitalism spectrum. And hopefully, because they all want good software, you can get them to cooperate. An interesting saga over the past year or so has been regarding sort of source management. And the BitKeeper situation was an interesting one because it really played up the conflict between traditional revenue software generation and the stuff we do, which tends to not directly generate revenue from the source. One interesting thing about that also is that BitKeeper was explicitly designed to solve this set or a set of source management and project management issues for the open source community. And it turned out that one of the primary characteristics of that for the open source community was an open source license. In a lot of ways. I mean, there are many people who vary in the level of pragmatism there who are willing to use it if it helps them get the job done better. People use PowerPoint, too. But that there was sufficiently visible demand for, or at least need for that, and that need could be translated into a piece of software and then at the very end basically be stymied in terms of adoption by the licensing situation was pretty telling, we're still pretty far apart in terms of a lot of the people who are still building software. Who did that? That's pretty spooky. People who are still building software in the traditional software for money world and people who are building software and want to have a wider variety of options available to their consumers. And we'll see how that ends. CVS, as everybody who's worked with it knows, is not a perfect tool. No. but it seems to be the best we've got right now that fits our criteria for, you know, useful piece of source management software and can be openly distributed and modified and so forth. There's room there for improvement, certainly, even within the space of CVS. And I understand there's been a recent development there. Someone's rewritten all the networking code, which is always a good place to start with that sort of stuff.
I think you should also look at Aegis, which is a GPL
integration. Yeah, Aegis and PRCS and so forth. And that's interesting because there do exist these software tools that solve these problems in different ways and solve these problems in, many people would argue, better ways, and yet we still all end up with CVS. There's a gentleman that I work with who believes that CVS has inherent value because it makes you keep your source management simple, that if you're clean under CVS, as he says, you're clean under everything. And it may be that our development methodologies and so forth are still, I don't want to use the word immature, but still in flux sufficiently that having CVS sort of keep our training wheels on is a good thing for now. But certainly Aegis PRCS PRCS 2, I guess, has been on the horizon for a little while now, although I guess it still doesn't do client-server completely. I could be out of date on that. So yeah, there are other tools there, but I think it'll be a long time before we find something that supplants CVS simply because it solves the vast majority of the problems and it doesn't make you pay too burdensome a price for your simple source management. Bug fixes that would be welcome aside. So another interesting piece of this in terms of our tools and our practices, and this was something that my life revolved around when I was working on Mozilla full-time, was bug tracking. Not just because Mozilla has a fair number of bugs, but basically because that was what we used for project and program management. We were very much driven by the bug system. We would track things in it that really genuinely weren't bugs in terms of new features and integration points and compatibility issues. Lots of simple but powerful dependency management. And there are other bug tracking tools as well. The bug tracking tools tend to fall reasonably short, and Bugzilla does a pretty good job with this, but again, significant room for improvement, as with all these tools, and yet nobody really improves them to this level. I don't know why. Is the ability for people to sort of follow the whole process of what they report. What's going on upstairs? Okay. Oh, okay. I thought we were going to have a Ghostbusters scene there for a second. Is the ability for someone to come in and report something about the software, that they want a new feature, that they've found a defect, that they have want compatibility with something. They tend to not be general end-user requests or support issues, or if they are, the bugs tend to be closed somewhat curtly. But to follow that process through, and I think that's a really valuable thing in terms of figuring out how we're going to interact with the community at large. I should actually ask a question here before I go any further. How many people here actively develop free or open source software? That's pretty good. So Chris is still raising his hand in the back because he does it a lot. The issue there in terms of keeping people involved in your community and keeping people interested in the software and letting them add the value that they can add, people who can't write software, people who can't even be trusted to write documentation, which is actually a lot of people who write software, people can still be involved in or have a sense of involvement in the software that they're using and that they're interested in the development of if there's a way for them to track the development of the software in the areas they care about. And some of that is just, you know, CVS and Banzai techniques, weekly status reports, watching for the occasional update on fresh meat. But I think there's a lot of room for improvement there also in terms of how we interact with people who are end users of our software. And that's the thing here, end user support. I was thinking about this as I rode into Ottawa, actually. It used to be believed that only large companies could, working in pretty rigorous conditions, could produce, you know, really good software. And I think we've seen that that's not really the case, that you can produce software without the benefit of some over-umbrella corporate organization or traditional software methodology, that sort of stuff. I'm wondering whether we draw the line there. Right now there's a belief that if you really want support and service, you're going to give money to a company. And that fact, a lot of the open source world right now operates as in a fashion that indicates the software is a way to deliver a service or a reason to deliver the service. We've got a number of companies that have popped up that do support of open source software and do support integration with it and traditional professional services. I see some Linux Care people and Helix Code people in here, and they're all well familiar with the way to get money from that process. But I wonder whether that's going to continue as well, whether we're going to find in 6 months, in a year, in 10 years, that you can actually deliver good open support, or whether there's something inherent about the development of software that makes people more willing to contribute to it, able to contribute to it at a sort of a higher quality level. I think it's a very interesting problem to solve, that you've got this body of software and you no longer know, for example, who's using it. You can no longer know what the installed base is for Linux, for Apache. You can generate some numbers that are probably somewhat better than just guessing or rolling dice, but it's hard to know based on that whether you're going to have a market for your support. It's hard to know based on that whether there's a demand for that support. And I think that a model that doesn't depend on those traditional techniques for, you know, driving a business case and so forth might be a more powerful way to support the software we're developing, where you have the support mechanisms that more closely mirror the development of the software. I think you can, again, get more people involved in that community and in that development process, and I think through that get better software for people. Security ports is a good example of how a lot of our processes break down, especially in projects where there's not an obvious single point of contact, which to some extent is Linux kernel. My most recent experiences with this were with Mozilla. What do you do with a security bug? Who do you notify about that? How long do you wait before you make it public? What do you do when you have the fix? And as you get vendors and other people other than the developers distributing this software, in Mozilla case there are many, in the Linux case there are a number of distributions, it's a hard thing to balance in terms of you want people who use the software through the vendors because that's how they want to use their software. You want them to be able to be protected in a reasonable way, but you don't want to delay the world for a couple high latency vendors. And we don't really have a good answer to that either, except that it tends to get public very quickly, and you drive vendors to creating fixes very quickly through that. It's not clear to me that that's the best way to do it. You end up with an antagonism there that I think is perhaps counterproductive. And you also end up not being able to take as much care with the security fixes as you often would take with the rest of your software. One of the things that that open source gets a lot of value from, I think, is the wide level of peer review, the long-standing review, the availability of source and close inspection, and to rush through a security fix, especially to rush it through in a, I mean, they're often very well considered and they're often very effective, but they tend to not get as wide a review, and to my mind, that's sort of backwards in that you want that security review on, you want more review on the stuff that's more critical, and a lot of pieces of software, that's a security issue. PubContrib is a reference there to how we deal with, obviously I'm not talking quickly enough, how we deal with software that's not developed by the core developers, people who are who don't want to be a part of that core project, people who are building Apache add-ons, and Apache does a very good job with this, as does Zope. People who are building things on top of the technology that aren't inherently necessarily useful to the same aims as the people developing the underlying technology or don't fit well with it, are useful for different communities, and how you keep that interaction healthy. A lot of the best software out there gets a lot of its value added from, you know, things that it was never intended for. A good piece of software, you know you've created something interesting when it's used for something you would have never used it for. And how we interact with that stuff is still, I think, a largely unsolved problem. How you find the software you're interested in, how you can see how other people have solved the problems you're trying to solve, how to make it easy to contribute your source code. There's a fair amount of overhead and a fair amount of energy that has to go into releasing and maintaining and contributing source code, and making that easier for people to do, making that easier for other people to help with, I think could add a lot of value to what we're doing as well. I tried for a long time to get prettier fonts on this thing. But I don't blame Mozilla. So one of our sort of organizational choices you have to make is how you're going to organize your project, how we're going to organize the decision-making process. And democracy is a pretty bad way to do it, I think. And I'll attempt to make a convincing argument for that. Democracy presumes that that all people in a decision have sort of an equal investment in it and should have equal influence on it. But more significantly, it presumes that that there's inherent value in having only one decision reached. So you end up, in some cases, and this is an example that I think exists more in fiction than in fact, but I hear it often enough that I'm interested in relating it. That's really good. I guess it's been up for years, and his talk's going better than mine.
Shorter.
Maybe that's why it's going better than mine. One of the things people asked at Netscape when we started to do open source, people have asked as I've been trying to do zero knowledge, and as I've talked to other people about sort of companies, especially companies moving from a traditional, very tightly controlled proprietary software model into doing open development, well, how do you control what code goes into the tree? And I like to give the answer that you control it the same way you do now, right? You've got a review process, right? And you if someone looks at the code and decides it should be in there or shouldn't, and if one of your employees ran off and wrote a chunk of code you didn't want to be in the tree, it wouldn't go in the tree, right? And I get some dumbfounded or slightly embarrassed looks sometimes. Well, we should do that, or no, we do that, but we think it should be different in this case. And in the real sort of democratic sense, and you see this in articles about Linux a lot, how anybody can contribute code to it. Well, not really anybody can, and there's a reason for that. Because if anybody could contribute code to it, you'd soon have a piece of software that was not useful to anybody. You can see this some days on the GNOME tip, that everybody's throwing stuff in. And they're actually better organized than most democracies. There's a lot of risk there. That's one case that's very democratic in sort of a code sense. Anybody can vote with their editor. But I think there's a lot of risk there as well. I think there's probably more risk than value there. Another thing that comes out of this is a schedule pressure issue, which I experienced pretty fiercely when I was at Netscape doing Mozilla work. What happens when you have a vendor that wants to ship something based on this source tree, and you see it with Linux and the distributions, you've seen it for years, and maybe the development of that code isn't done yet in the eyes of the developers. Maybe they're not ready to have a final release. So they're still checking in fast and heavy on the CVS tree, and they're still adding features, and of course they're breaking things occasionally, or they're re-architecting stuff. And you've got this vendor that, you know, wants to burn some CDs and wants to be able to field this tech support group in support of this stuff. So they don't want as much churn on that tree. I don't think we've had a good answer to that problem yet. I think in Mozilla's case we haven't. We're just getting into this area with zero knowledge, and I hope we can find a better way to do it. But I'm not sure what that better way is, because you fundamentally have, especially where a vendor is doing significant amounts of contribution to the code, you have this democratic issue where, well, our developers are working on this or our developers aren't, and we want to exert influence over the tree such that it meets our goals. And that's, of course, why one of the reasons people do contribute to open source is they're scratching their itch. But when your itch is moving a lot or no one will let you, you know, scratch it effectively, you end up with this sort of the last problem on the list, which is self-forking. One of the things we talk about a lot as a risk in the source community, especially as related to licenses, is what the possibility of a fork is. And when we started to dual license some code of Mozilla, the JavaScript engine, NSPR, one of the things people were afraid of is, what if someone just takes this code and continues with it under a single license? What if they fork it and we never get access to those changes back? Doesn't that really defeat the point of what we're doing? And it is bad. Forking, you know, increases administrative overhead. You want to have the opportunity to do it. You want to have the ability to vote your leaders out of power, but you don't want to have it. It's disruptive to the organization to have to do it a lot. So you often see, and we see this in the Mozilla world as well, where we put people on branches and say, it'll be all stable off where you are, and we'll not do things over there, but then you're on a branch, and branches are their own special pain. Part of this comes out of the third point as well, which is decision latency. When you've got a lot of people that have to be involved in making a decision, you know, I want to make this architectural change. Well, post to the news group and see what people think about that. Send some mail out and see what people think about that. Or wait to hear back from the plug-in people or people who are building modules on top, see what they thought about it. It can take a long time to make decisions, and that can really slow down the ability to develop software. And that's another temptation then to sort of self-fork, that we're going to go off and experiment and do this thing that we know to be obviously correct on one branch, and the rest of the world can do their horribly misguided thing on this other branch. But at some point, you have to reconcile that, or you've got two pieces of software. And again, you have that fork cost that's you see with Emacs and Xemacs that hard to resolve. Now, they weren't strictly driven by technical issues or issues of disagreement about the source code, but pretty painful schism nonetheless. And a lot of effort goes into writing stuff that's compatible with both, and a lot of effort is sort of lost to the friction cost of having two versions around. You see with some cases, GCC and EGCS, that they can be resolved, although it was resolved in that case by letting GCC die. And neither of the Emacs guys seem to be willing to let that happen. Is there a good VI split too? I like Emacs. I hate having to talk about that all the time. But
how about SSH?
SSH. Well, and SSH was in a lot of ways driven by the licensing. SSH 2 being evil, evil, evil. And that's another case. I mean, we talk about that, a lot of that in the risk, terms of risk of the licensing. And one of the things about a really permissive license, something that has a weak copy left, as RMS would say, is that you can do that. You can take this license that you can take code that's under, you know, it's in the public domain or BSD without advertising, that sort of thing. You can use it in these other ways that make it incompatible with the original source code in terms of licensing. And that can drive forks. But also, one of the things about having source available software is that, you know, people can just go out and write their own. One of the goals of, I think, any successful software project is to make it so that people are not motivated to go out and write another one. Mozilla project is highly motivated to not have anybody else have to go and write another web browser, perhaps too highly motivated. But yeah, the SSH case is a good example there, where although it's not really two pieces of open source software, as I understand the licensing on it, but re-implementation is a common source of open source stuff, right? You get the OpenSSH world that's, you know, it's really taking off. A lot more people are using that now. And that, again, threatens the revenue model, people who wanted to charge money for SSH. And they're, you know, if they go to business, does it do us any good? Will they go and hack on OpenSSH? Maybe? No? It's not clear what the right thing to do is there, whether it's lobby and lobby and lobby and lobby, which worked a little bit with the QT guys in Norway to get it under a license that's more compatible. Maybe that could have averted the whole GNOME KDE thing, although maybe people would have still wanted to drive the fire truck. So tyranny doesn't work very well either. I had a good example of this. Can't recall it now. Some of the Emacs splits, I guess, were driven by a form of tyranny, although committee-based tyranny. It's hard to motivate people to contribute when they don't feel they have a lot of decision-making power and what happens after that. I mean, you see this even in companies where you're paying people. This whole empowerment thing is a really big deal for a pretty good reason, which is that people are going to be more interested in what they're doing and they're going to be better able to contribute in a lot of ways if they really feel invested in it, if they really feel that they can control their fate in that area too. And some of that's out of their ability to drive value from it. If, you know, Willie can run off and subvert this process or make changes to the software that make it harder for me to do what I wanted to do with the software in the first place, it's not clear that I should be investing a lot of my time there. It raises the risk a lot, and a lot of sort of successful evangelism and project management is about risk reduction. It sort of works counter to the goals there. Visibility of contribution is something that I didn't know which slide this should have gone on, so it's here now, so I can talk about it later. something that's a pretty big motivator for a lot of, especially small companies I've found, contributing to open source projects is sort of the PR value of it. Being able to say, you know, we have experts in this field, some of it because they're selling a service based on it, some of it because they're selling, you know, their web design company or their web applications company, and they want to say, yeah, we hacked on Apache. We've got experts in these browser technologies and these server-side technologies. It's a way to demonstrate stuff and it's a way to get their name out there. And visibility of that contribution is an important motivator, but when you're in a tyrannical model, and I don't think of the Linux kernel model as overly tyrannical, it's sort of a benevolent dictatorship, which is, of course, the most perfect form of government. Yeah, there are quite a few good examples of that. The QEMU one's good. Yeah, there was a Fuhrer on the Linux kernel list. Oh, we're talking about tyranny, about advertising in boot up messages and that sort of stuff. Again, a visibility issue, and with the right balance of tyranny and democracy, people can make the appropriate decisions for themselves, whether they're going to see that or not. The GPL, of course, as a license, has some characteristics in it that are often violated, I think, in terms of what you can and must do and can't do in terms of startup notifications and that sort of stuff. But again, that visibility issue is an important one for motivating people to contribute and to continue to contribute. You see this sometimes where people's code is rewritten. Someone wrote this piece of software that, whether they think it was perfect software or not, are often sort of bothered or offended or put out when that software disappears and is replaced by something else, sometimes because, you know, they take it as an insult, sometimes because they no longer have as much sort of active position in that world. And the viability of the contribution is another thing, which is sort of related to that, where if I'm gonna contribute some patch to make SendMail speak LDAP or make anything speak LDAP for that matter, and in the long term, you know, the architecture is going to change in such a way that I'm gonna have to invest a lot of effort to maintaining that. I'm gonna have to invest a lot of effort to keeping it working. It's not clear that's a model I'm going to want to participate in. So again, you've got two evils. And it gets pretty cliched to say it, but I don't know what the slide is that the sort of Linux kernel model that they have there, where you've got it's okay to have these long-standing patches that live off on their own, and Andrea's MM patches are like that, and the AC patches that grow to megs in size sometimes. That they're done with the motivation of getting them back in the mainline so that everybody can benefit from their development and maintenance is significant, but that you can have these sort of short periods on an informal mailing list branch, I think is indicative of a pretty healthy model. And that Linus is willing occasionally to admit he might have been wrong in the past, maybe, is healthy to that as well. It's almost at the end of my slides. Isn't that disappointing? But that's okay, because I can talk about these for hours. Stuff that's sort of open in the future. Checklisting here is how to start with this. I believe that in sometime in the near future, open source is going to be what open standards was in the 90s, which is something everybody has to be able to say about themselves. If you were buying internet technology, if you were buying networking technology in the 90s, everything was open standards. Whether it really was open standards or not, everything wanted to be. Everything wanted you to believe you could be interoperable. And since our implementation is the best, you never want to use anyone else's, but you could. That open source is a controlled trademark, it reduces the risk of that somewhat, that it'll be used meaninglessly, assuming that people can actually enforce the use of that trademark. But I think checklisting there is going to be a significant driver for release under an open source license. I know for us at Zero Knowledge it was, we wanted to be open source compatible, and that was a goal because it existed. It's not obvious in a lot of cases whether those goals are ones that are inherently valuable for software developers in all cases, but they're well enough established and they serve as a useful sort of intellectual shorthand that people are going to follow that a lot. Another interesting thing was that I've talked to people about sort of building Linux software, and you're going to build stuff to enter the Linux market. And a lot of people really believe you can't credibly bring a product to market in the Linux world right now without having source available for it, that's just not what the community will... The community's spoiled now, right? We've got all this good software that's open source. We've got some that isn't. We got some open source software that's not very good. But that it's really a strong expectation of the community, I think, is really going to be a powerful motivator in this area. The Linux desktop numbers are growing, and people estimate them, you know, 12 million maybe, or maybe 20, or maybe 4. But it's still a lot of seats, and if people want to get software into those spaces, it's quite likely that making it open source will help that. There are a lot of distribution channels, Debian is a good example of it, that are only really viable for you if you're open source. if you can really get in. They have their non-free section, but it tends to not be as widely distributed. So this other open question, and one that I talked a bit about at dinner yesterday, I talked about this a couple weeks ago with some friends. Nobody really knows what to do with this yet. And again, if you do, bring the noise. Patents and software licensing. There are a number of sort of traditional open source companies, even now Linux vendors and the like, that are taking out defensive patents because they're concerned that there'll be, you know, someone else will get a patent on this, or that the prior art isn't clear enough, especially with the U.S. Patent Office's sort of hazy view of prior art. And even just defending yourself against a bogus patent is a pain. So I think we're going to see more activity in our little world about this stuff in the future. And as we were quite public about some time ago, Zero Knowledge has quite a number of patents now related to Stefan Brand's technologies. And what we're going to do with that, if we want to do open source software with it, what we're going to do with our patents is still a hard issue. The only really credible stuff I've heard, actually, I guess, I don't know if it was originally from John Gilmore, if he just spoke about it more frequently where I could read it, is the idea of a patent pool, where you put your patents in a jar, basically. Anybody who wants into the jar can take whatever they want, but they have to put all their patents in the jar, too. This works best with a license that's a strong copyleft, like the GPL, where it's pretty clear you don't have as many aggregation issues and so forth that are easy to manipulate. But even then, a lot of the ways people license their patents are based on the environment in which they're being used and not the terms under which they're being used, which is an important distinction. And it's not clear that our software licenses don't do that because the open source guidelines forbid it. You can't have a license that says you can't use it in military use, or you can't use it if you're a bank, or you can't use it if, you know, you're left-handed. And so it's going to be hard for traditional patent models, which are very much driven by that, right? How big are the pockets of the people who are licensing this software from you? Are they going to be using it to derive revenue? Are they going to be using it to drive adoption? Are they going to be using it in a way that helps us sell these things later? There's an incompatibility there. And if the patent pool is the only way to solve that, I think we have some problems, because there are a lot of entities that are for which that's not. I mean, you're never going to get, I don't think you're ever going to get, I'd love to be wrong about this, if nothing else. You never get IBM to be in a patent pool like that, because they have so much, you know, AT&T, Lucent, they have so much of their revenue, so much of their corporate existence is driven around the possession and control of those patents. You almost want a developer model. Now, there's always, the original patent holder does have rights to that patent, so someone who doesn't want to get into the pool can still pay money for it. But that's sort of an out-of-band thing, and it doesn't really help those of us who want to build open source software and want to deliver it under those open source terms, that you can use this software. And strictly speaking, it's orthogonal, but really, fundamentally, to use a piece of software that's in a patented area, you need to worry about the patents, even if the software itself permits it to be used. So I think there's going to be a lot of interesting discussion about that in the next year or so, maybe some right now.
It might be worth mentioning AT&T's Patent Line license. One way, if you sue anyone that's contributed to Patent Line over a patent, you immediately lose all rights to using Patent Line.
That's pretty interesting. I don't know if probably not everybody heard that. One of the characteristics of the Plan 9 license, under which AT&T released Plan 9, surprisingly enough, is that if you sue anybody who contributed to Plan 9 over a patent, you lose the right to use Plan 9. So I guess that's a deterrent for people who've deployed it, or maybe it's something that will keep companies who have an interest in patent issues from deploying it. I guess it could motivate people to contribute, too, right? If you find out that Amazon or whatever is using Plan 9, or you know, you contribute to Plan 9, you can get around some of those sort of unfortunate patent characteristics where the simple act of defending yourself against what is arguably, in some cases, a bogus patent. My experiences at Netscape with the Wang Save As patent were like that. It's just clear that it's not the case. It's clear that patents shouldn't have been granted or shouldn't have scope this broad an application. But it's also clear you have to pay a heck of a lot of money to prove that to a court of law, even when you get to the very fastest version of that process, which I think we experienced there, where it was just thrown out based on prior art, largely contributed by, in some cases, by the open source community. It's still expensive, and AOL's legal team is bigger than most open source projects' entire staff, so it's not clear that we can follow that model. Support and adoption. I touched on this earlier in terms of how we support our users, whether we can do the same thing for support that we've already done for software development. And I imagine there are a couple companies that are probably nervous about that, but there were companies who were nervous about the idea that someone could give away software that competed with theirs for free. Support tends to be a harder problem because you tend to write software for people who use software, and people who use that software use it in a variety of different ways. If you're a developer, you're going to hear back about some things, but there's this inherent barrier to entry that you have to be able to you know, you have to be able to drive majordomo, more or less, or you have to be able to, you know, decipher the documentation to figure out where to send this feedback and understand what comes back. I think there's an interesting problem to solve there in terms of how you support people who just happen to be using GNOME, right? Somebody tricked their grandmother and installed it on their desktop, and how does that grandmother get, you know, how do I make GMC stop popping up when I start up GNOME? And why does the panel crash when I add this applet and that sort of stuff? How do they deal with that? Or how do they ask for new things in that software? Bug tracking software and open bug tracking software is one way to do that, but I wouldn't want to have my grandmother have to go through Bugzilla. There's a lot of people who I would not have judged to be, based on their Bugzilla entries, very quick off the mark, have been able to successfully navigate Bugzilla enough to send me mail about it. So maybe there's actually hope there. And that support issue also drives adoption, right? Companies who are going to deploy a piece of software and are going to be, you know, especially where they're going to deliver services on top of that. If you're Hotmail, if you're Yahoo, and you're delivering, you know, email for millions of people, or your critical path, and you're being paid to do it instead of just giving it away, and there's this sort of strong bond of contract there, what happens if a downstream piece of software breaks, right? You're going to buy hardware from somebody who's going to give you a warranty. You know, if VA didn't offer warranties on their hardware, they would sell a lot fewer units, I think. And IBM and SGI have always done this as well, that, you know, you're buying from us and you're going to get good support at the back end of it. You can do that now for some pieces of software, SendMail and GNOME and Apache. There's groups that do this for Apache and so forth, and some catch-all organizations like LinuxCare that will support anything, basically, if you give money for it. But it's not clear to me that that's the best way to do it, because those people tend to be disconnected in a lot of cases from development. They tend to not have the same interactions with the developers that make open source a valuable world, where you can see what the pathology of this issue was. You can see why these decisions were made. You can participate in making those decisions in the future. The users of that software need to be well represented there. So maybe you end up with a representation by population thing. But again, that sort of thing, I think, limits the adoption we're going to see. That even just that you have to go to different people, that you download SendMail from one site and you call SendMailLink to get it. They're pretty tightly done, but the GNOME stuff is maybe a better example. You get it off of some generic mirror site, or it came with Red Hat and you want to get support for it. Where do you go? Maybe to Red Hat, but maybe not. How we interact with non-developers. There was a thread on Avogadro about this many moons ago when I last checked Avogadro. I'm very bad with that. About how we deal with people who aren't writing software, who aren't actually, like, you know, writing code, people who are doing icons, people who are doing documentation, people who are writing how-tos or helping people install it, or just people who use the software. It's hard to get into that world. I mean, I'm a developer, but when I'm working with software, I'm working with people who on software that I'm not actively developing on. You can tell you're on the outside looking in, and that's, I think, again, a harmful thing. I think there's a lot of value we can get from listening to our users if we can make it easier for them to communicate to us. And I think that there are lots of pieces of software that aren't code, or that aren't sort of traditional code, people writing test cases, people managing those test cases and regressions. I mean, if Tinderbox is state of the art, we've got a long way to go. It started up. That's not enough information for people. So how we interact with those developers is a hard thing too. Maybe we just invite them into our community under the terms we're in now. Come into the mailing list, kick some stuff around. You know, if you want to write documentation about how to use this software, you have to learn how to use it like everybody else did, which is, you know, a little bit of guesswork, a little bit of reading the source, a little bit of asking questions on mailing lists. And there's probably a better way. And it's not clear that people who are not as into software as developers, or who are not into it in that way, are going to be willing or able to participate in those mechanisms. Again, I wouldn't want my grandmother on Linux kernel. Certainly not reading some of my old posts. Alan Cox's keynote last year was about Murphy's Law certainly applies. Whether Moore's Law, no, Brooks' Law, applies to open source software development, whether you can beat that by being properly parallelized. And well, I have some things to talk to him about on that front. One of the things that he really talked about there was that you can add more people to a project by basically giving them a new project. You can have more people work on this bubble that's GNOME by expanding the bubble a little bit to include a calendar tool or include, you know, sorry, a new CD, an IRC client. They're really hurting for IRC clients, as it turns out. And that's okay if you're building lots of little programs, but as Miguel mentioned, we need a better way to, you want to really be able to reuse that code. You want to really be able to build things that are more than just, you know, shell scripts and so forth, and have richer interactions between programs than streams of text, or streams of binary data, I guess, for some of the image tools. But still, with sort of modular software, and honestly, I think there's a lot of things, something that the Windows platform got right. Stuff that's properly modular, stuff that you can replace at runtime, stuff that you can add to in a generic way, you can hook up in a low impact way. You can really get over that Brooke's Law hump in a more flexible way for the architecture of your software, where someone can write. And you see this in the kernel, right? If you're writing a file system, you don't need to care about the device driver that's talking to this piece, and you can parallelize that really well. But not all software is as clean cut as that. And we're seeing work on that front now. We see Bonobo, you see Kparts, you saw OpenDoc. The Mozilla XPCOM model, obviously close to my heart. The ability to build software out of these components, and we're fair ways from that right now. I think we've got a lot of people who are worried about how we're going to build those components and how they're going to talk to each other, but the next piece there of how we're going to easily build software to those components and how we're going to make it meaningful to be able to add a new type of component into an existing application without having to re-architect it all, those are still unsolved problems. Not just for us. I think those are unsolved problems for a lot of development communities, a lot of people working with other toolkits, not in the graphical sense. And I think solving that is something that could win us a lot, I think, especially because open source has the ability to get a lot of people on board, has the ability to really take advantage of that potential for parallelization, give us just the right amount of democracy. So I think I'm largely done. Before I go, I want to plug something because you're all here rapidly following me. We actually released source today. No, really. Yeah. So I shouldn't be applauding me. I feel like people responsible for that are in the back of the room here, and they could stand up, but they'll be all embarrassed, so they might not want to. But they're all turning now. It's good. The Linux client people and so forth are here. Other people working on the client. I don't know if Phil's around still. Sick for a couple days, and he helped me get the last piece of this done. So we're in that world now, too. And hopefully I'll be able to give a different talk next year about sort of what we learned over the next year of this, because we're really just starting on that. And we got the first piece of our software out. Like all processes like this, it's harder than we thought it would be. And there's still lots of work left to be done there, but it's exciting for me to be yet again in this sort of open world, be able to take advantage of some of this stuff. So thank you all for your time. Take questions if you have them. And you don't, so we can all go get beer now. Oh, you. Yes, hot dog? Unless your grandmother was Goldman Sachs, perhaps, but yes.
That's exactly right. If you're Goldman Sachs or GM or something like that, you might have a chance of getting it changed. Or if you're a major software developer. But so my feeling here is, let's not beat ourselves in the back too badly on that particular case of your grandmother trying to get her favorite thing into the product, okay? I think she actually has a better chance in the Linux space than she does in the Microsoft space.
And that's very likely true. I've actually been through the vendor support pain a couple times relatively recently. The important thing there for me is there's an element there that perception is reality. There's an element that you know who you got your software from, that it's branded in that way, and that you believe that you can get this from such and such. Whether you can or not, and that you're very correct that that's an important distinction, and that perhaps one we should be louder about. I'm concerned about how those people get involved in our community. I think people who are members of our community have an easier time of getting those things changed and fixed. But it's not clear to me that people who are outside that community have as easy a time. And now, I guess I'm in the community, so it's hard for me to judge what that really looks like on the outside. But I'm wary of that. It may be that it's a much better situation than I think. But maybe just striving for improvement, constant. No, that's pretty cheesy. Yeah.
But along the same lines, I think that the large number of local user groups who are very knowledgeable about Linux give us a chance. Your grandmother could at least go to the local user group, and they usually have a fairly good idea of how to get things back into the Linux community.
That's true.
Versus in the Microsoft local user group, I don't even know where they are. So
That's true. And that may be a good model for us to do that end user support, is in that distributed mechanism that we see with the users groups.
Or sysadmins at large companies. I mean, they'll often act as a mentor. You know, when a system admin has to, when an independent Linux developer, you know, says, oh, wow, what a great email feature, we'll add that evolution, you know, and it works wonderfully for 50,000 one machine home systems or desktop workstations all managed by one sysadmin, but I go and deploy it on 400 machines in a single department, you often end up with a very different view of that feature's viability.
Yeah.
What happens is the system admin, not the user, will take the lead role going back to the original development community and say, hey, this smells weird.
Yeah, but then we have to be wary of that as well, that we, Mad Dog just mentioned, that if you're not a large software organization, you can't get these things fixed in our traditional proprietary model. I think we need to be careful that we make sure that we're not just listening to people who have 400 user installations.
Well, what I meant was that the system admin of 400 systems is far more likely to know what the support mechanisms are to communicate back to the developer. As a sysadmin of 400 systems, I'm going to be on the mailing list for that already. I'm going to know what, if any, bug system they have, whether the project is hosted in source.
That's reasonable.
FreshBeat or something. So regardless of whether I've got two systems or 400, if I'm a system admin for more than three computers, I'm hopefully going to know, well, you know, Mike Shaver, he's the head of Project XYZ. If I'm really irritated, I need to find out what his mailing list is for that project.
How are you going to meet my grandmother?
Well, at a log. We solved that earlier.
If your grandmother is a graduate student in the department, she's already my problem. You know, if your grandmother is at a nursing home and she's using the nursing home's computers, the nursing home system admin is already going to consider his or her problem. So the need for support will get distributed that way.
And I guess that's similar to the log argument, right? We use these local points of aggregation. We can aggregate the concerns of these users and provide these channels back. Maybe it's just a matter then of identifying those to the users. It's not clear to me, were I a graduate student, that I would go if I wanted a feature added to Elm. Well, okay, bad example, MUT, and tell my sysadmin that I wanted that done.
And by the way, these local user groups are also a good cushion against developers, because if somebody comes along and says, do you like to have this feature to the lug, and somebody at the lug says, oh, you know what would happen if you add that feature when you expand it to the 300 systems, it would go to hell, okay? Then you get a lot of feedback, you get workarounds and things like that. You know, you get support.
Yeah.
When I was
managing that support burden is significant as well, so that's certainly a value there.
When I was in digital, when we sold support contracts, we would always ask for a single point of contact out of a company. And two reasons for that. Number one, they could track the issue and keep a hold of it. But number two, all the I don't know what I'm doing people would go to them to complain about things that they thought didn't work.
Thank you.
Then they would show them how to do it. And then complain to us if it was a real problem.
So you read through the cache there. Yeah, now that's...
I'm part of one of the more active lugs down in North Carolina. And it doesn't happen all the time, but we do occasionally have people on various projects that have no inherent knowledge of our lug say, hey, they've been around for a while. They will occasionally float us ideas. Would you try this feature, try this patch? Because they know that the majority of members in that lug are going to have been there for a while. They're going to be fairly Linux aware, and it's a little better than the hit or miss you tend to get if you put a patch on FreshBeat.
And that's a technique that actually a lot of Linux vendors have used traditionally to identify beta programs and early release. So that here with Ocklug and the NetWinder. So maybe that's our answer. Maybe that's the distributed support model we need.
I can foresee more of it. I think the feedback that they get back from either lugs or targeted beta programs or something like that is better than the 600 whining people on Linux kernel, you know, complaining that they added this patch and now they can't recompile the kernel because they didn't read the README.
People who are recompiling the kernel having problems and are actually reading Linux kernel, I think, are to the right half of the bell curve in terms of the ability to... I mean, I think we have the bigger problem in the kernel space is that people pull down the development kernels because they have a bigger number and they compile them and they run into problems, but they're not on the mailing lists and they don't know where to read that stuff, or they don't bother to. But yeah, in the beta case, and when you're looking for sort of Linux power users, that's where that stuff exists. Excellent. Ted?
Yeah, you talked earlier briefly about patents and
concern as soon as you start getting into ASP, because you can now have a commercial ASP site deriving commercial value from your GPL code. And the fact that they're not distributing the mods to the GPL code means that the GPL restrictions don't apply, but yet they're doing this commercial ASP thing, and quote-unquote, is that right? And there are a whole bunch of associated issues, you know, components, if you don't actually dynamically link against the GPL code,
you
need to connect to do stuff, should the GPL be able to infect across HTTP connections?
I'm glad you used the word infect before I did. And that's a hard case because you don't want your GPL web browser to taint Apache when you load a page off of it. So there's been some doctrine there, practice if not written, that if you can plug in another implementation, then you don't taint across whatever that boundary is, right? Where you can plug in another version of readline, or you can plug in another version of curses or whatever, libc, although the system exemption in some of those cases. That you can derive value, commercial value from a piece of software, I don't see as a big, I mean, people, we've already seen that whether they're deriving commercial value in that case or not, I don't think matters. I think we really want to have the same rules, whether this is, you know, LoudCloud is building this stuff and charging money for it, whether you've got, you know, OpenASP that provides these services for free to charities or to other open source projects like SourceForge does. That they're driving commercial value doesn't matter to me as much. But certainly that most of our software licenses, copyleft components, only kick in at the point of distribution makes for a hard problem. You can imagine a case, there's an example of this going the other way. A lot of Microsoft fonts, you can download them, but you can't distribute them. So there's talk of little magic RPMs, which when you install them, go and pull this stuff off the site and pull it there. So there's no one's distributing these things together. There's no aggregation at the point of distribution. And if you have a sufficiently sort of fiscally motivated attacker on your software, you can do the same sort of thing where you've got some little installer and it pulls my GPL software from here and my big proprietary thing from there and this patent restricted piece from here, and the user did all that. That wasn't us. We didn't distribute it together. They had to click these buttons. So that's certainly an issue in terms of licensing, in terms of meeting the aims of our licenses rather than just meeting the words of them. And I don't know how we solve that. Describing software terms in a way that will make lawyers comfortable with the interpretation is going to be challenging, I think.
Yeah, because on the flip side, you don't want a GPL browser infecting your Apache web server, but there are some folks who have claimed, well, I don't want to open source the code to my, you know, Slashdot or SourceForge or whatever those are sites you have, but a concern that those people might have is someone will make proprietary changes to that code base and then make a commercial version of that site and compete against the original commercial version of the site without ever releasing the changes, because after all, they never distributed, so they don't have to release the changes.
Yeah, and
that may inhibit people who are developing those websites from actually releasing the source code as a result.
There's certainly issues there, but again, you could argue someone could go and reimplement Slashdot, and people have done that with Zope, for example. Squish.dot is pieces of Slashdot. Slashdot, I don't think, derives a lot of value from exclusive access to its software, and it knows that, so they've released the source to it under whatever license they've chosen. I think sometimes it's hard to generate sympathy within the community for companies that want to derive their value from having exclusive access to their software. One of the sort of the original tenets of the Free Software Foundation's mandate was that people should have access to the software so they're not beholden to a single vendor, so that they can make these modifications, so that they can support it beyond the lifetime of the vendor, beyond the lifetime of the vendor's interest in that software. So companies that want to keep that stuff proprietary, is that any different than a company that wants to keep its web browser proprietary, keep its operating system proprietary? Is distribution really significant? Part of that? So you want a license that it enforces on use or something. And yet the open source guidelines explicitly state that there's this capacity there for privacy, that you can make local modifications and not have to distribute those changes, that you can make a change for use within your individual, but typically that means organization under the law, and not have to distribute those changes out for reasons, I mean, explicitly stated for reasons of privacy. So those things I think are going to compete quite unpleasantly.
Maybe I should say, look, you took a copy of my website and enhanced it in this proprietary way. but because you're not distributing it, I don't actually get those enhancements back. And I wanted the GPL to do that.
Maybe there was something to those look and feel lawsuits after all.
Yeah, and it's an interesting question of whether or not that should be allowed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's an interesting open question.
And maybe what we need to do is, I hate to say it, maybe we need a new license. Maybe we need a license of people that lets people make that decision, lets people say, I want this to be, if you're delivering services to somebody outside your organization, you're using it as part of this value chain, then you have to deliver your source code. Maybe you have to just have to deliver revenue if you don't want your source code to... I don't know that it's stronger. I don't know if the coffee left is any stronger. I think it applies in different circumstances. It could be quite possible to distribute that software to people and not give them the changes, as long as you're not deploying it. The room for interpretation there is pretty huge. Yeah, again, competitive advantage that comes out of exclusive access to software is something that I think generally I've seen the open source community to be sort of against, that people believe that you should win on other terms. But yeah, I mean, that's obviously an issue. If you're distributing the tools that you use to generate revenue and you believe that your company's primary value comes from exclusive access to those tools, you have a problem. One could argue you should try to find a way for your company to deliver unique value in another way, but that's not really tremendously interesting to a lot of the sets of problems. But yeah, people, and you see software as a service. You see software largely as a way to deliver or as a way to drive revenue for a service. We're going to see more of that. And yeah, I don't know how we prevent that, because there are a lot of edge cases you catch with that you probably don't intend to catch. I think we might be done. So we can all go drink beer now before the next talk. Did I actually run over? No. Quarter under. Good, good, good. We have another question. Go ahead. No problem. Yeah, the question, and please correct me if I repeat this incorrectly. When you started to build a piece of software, started on a project, you have to make selection of your tools. You basically have to set up the environment, the context in which you're going to develop this software, programming languages, source management tools, coding style even. And I guess the question was about the tension between your personal view of sort of technical superiority versus the effects of the choice of the tool and your ability to attract people, right? If you may believe that BitKeeper is a vastly superior piece of software and that it can help you solve these problems better, but if the rest of the world really wants to use CVS, what do you do with those tensions? In one sense, that's a hard question to answer, but in another sense, it's pretty easy. It's a matter of figuring out how those trade-offs are significant to you. If you're intending to write this code to solve this problem, and that's your primary motivation, which maybe it should be, pick the tools that help you get to that point. There aren't too many long-lived and very useful software programs and software projects that haven't changed direction in some significant way along the way. And it may be that you have to revisit your choice of tools. A lot of our tools especially programming languages, tie us into that pretty brutally. Some of the component architectures can make that easier. Bonobo, XPCOM, language independent. You can have many language bindings for it. I can write in Python, you can write in C, someone else can write in Java. And we can, look at the discuss to each other every time we get together at a conference, but our software can still talk together. Compatibility between source management tools and so forth. Again, someone has to develop that stuff. Someone has to see value in that sort of Swiss-style neutral ground. But I'm not sure that's a showstopper for a lot of... Do you have a personal experience with this? Where this was a significant issue for you, or...
Well, in general, observing all the different huge projects, like KDE, for example, and lot of people, it is already an issue which programming language people are choosing, or even the different programmers choose either to be written with Qt or with JTK, whatever. I mean, there's lots of examples.
Yeah, and that's a. That case is especially interesting because those environments derive a lot of their value from consistency, especially in the visual interface portion. That, you know, if you're to use a different toolkit, or you're going to use Motif and you're going to write some GNOME thing, even you're going to use some open source toolkit and you're going to do this thing. Is Motif really open source now? The license was, I thought not. Kinda. It's good. There's reasons there where they can't solve their problem without constraining the tool selection. Programming languages in that case may not be the same way. But again, you think of GNOME as
a good example of a tool that can be a hard date without the right tool around, because it's right in modular 3, and modular 3 compiler is quite raw. It's currently quite difficult to install it, so unfortunately most So we don't see any CVS of D running around, for even if there are so much CVS repository, it will be a really good tool for mirroring or things like this. But it's hard to maintain CVS of D, so you just see it in the FreeBSD community.
Yeah, and that's talking about CVS up, having chosen to write in a language that was not C or a derivative, and therefore is penalized by the world because they chose another programming language. And I think that's a great example of the tension you were talking about, where you've got this strong and often well-founded belief that you can get your problem solved better, more efficiently, save more safely, in prettier colors, this choice of tools, but the world conspires against you because people fear change, or people don't know those languages. There are, I think, really obviously a lot more C programmers than Modulo 3 programmers, so maybe you've got half of the Modulo 3 programmers in the world helping you with CVS up, but that may not be, if you're looking for breadth of adoption, that may not be the right choice, which is unfortunate that you'd have to make that trade-off. You'd have to use an inferior tool.
I'd actually characterize that differently, which is most of the value of C is the fact that there's a large base of other C programmers. So as far as maintainability is concerned, people actually help you pick patches, and that really is the network effect of C. And so one of the reasons why Java was a success is not the inherent superiority of the Java language. We can have a debate in the bar whether
Let's
or not.
Not do that here. Yeah.
But it was a marketing effort that Sun did to have everyone convince a large number of people that Java was this new happening thing, so they could jumpstart that community and get the network effect.
The self-fulfilling prophecy.
And I've actually found that's the exact problem BitKeeper has, which is everyone understands CVS. It took me a day to wrap my head around how BK works.
Yeah, but.
And
you're Ted. Yeah. And again, it's a hard thing to bootstrap. If you want to write your software in Haskell or something, and there are lots of good reasons to do that, you got an uphill battle to get that critical mass. But again, it can be a matter of something where, one significant project that really gets a lot of momentum behind it for reasons other than programming language choice can really cause it. We saw that with GDK and GIMP, right? That really, really helped it mature, really helped it take off, more people understood it. Started to be distributed separately. The rest is grisly mailing list history.
I'm also hearing another pattern here. People say, I want to work with the latest and greatest in technology, and backwards compatibility for me is not as big a deal as just starting off on this new project. If I had heard at some point that there was some way to arbitrarily convert my CVS repository into a BitKeeper repository, and go back again if I felt like backing out or sharing my data with somebody else, then I would have given it a better chance.
Yeah, and migration tools are, especially when you're in a space where there's competition, right? Migration tools are a great way to make
the first project in itself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, certainly. You have some issues there where your tools are at sort of a different semantic level. You've got some sort of impedance mismatch between BitKeeper and CVS, and you're going to lose data in that transformation. Maybe that's okay. Maybe we're willing to lose that data. If I was okay with CVS before, I can probably be okay with BitKeeper stuff, and I'm not going to. I may be able to experiment with it for a little while, and I may be able to say, when you perform this, batch change thing with BitKeeper, or you do this kind of branch merging, you're going to lose some data if you convert this through CVS again. Maybe those migration tools are good, but I think there are cases where where migration is not, I mean, you think of the KDE and GNOME case, what do migration tools help you do there, really? You get, you see stuff like KIMP, you wrap a KDE, or any other way around, GDK stuff wrapped around a, sort of a traditional KDE core, although the C++ angle tends to keep them away. There's some tool chain decisions where you can't bridge easily. You could bridge in that case. You could have a CVS to BitKeeper proxy thing, and that would be okay, but programming languages is harder. You end up having to do more complicated stuff with component architectures and language independence. And you get into organizational style issues, too, where I may believe that, you know, having daily releases and having stuff all have to run through 8 code reviewers and be internationalized before it hits the tree. You know, there are lots of programming doctrines that say, you know, you write as much test as you write code, and they tend to be pretty pleasant to work with. But again, I have to make a trade-off. If I require that of people who are going to contribute to my system, to my software, I'm gonna they're gonna follow my rules. I'm gonna be very happy about that, but I'm gonna reduce the number of people who are gonna be able to contribute. So again, you get the network effect, but you also get this sort of organizational trade-off. Maybe we can solve that. Maybe that's something where you just need to pick your favorite pet language or your favorite pet toolkit and do something really cool with it that attracts developers to it. That wasn't a very satisfying answer. Okay, we are done now. Thank you very much for your time.